Hi, welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm Andrew Kadenek. Joining me is John Purcell and a hero of both of ours, Peter Garrett. Peter, thanks for joining us.
No worries, guys.
So we're talking about Big Blue Sky, your memoir, which is, John, I think you had it perfectly when you talked about a possible three volume of what the book actually is.
Well, that's what the thing is. When you look at Peter's life, you've got three different lives. I mean, you've been very busy.
Yeah.
For a man who looks so young.
you can't see the inside.
You've done a rock star, activist, successful activist, environmental activist, and successful politician, with in government as a minister. That's a big life. That's a big life just for one of those.
I have been hard at it, and I think it's because I really wanted to live a public life. I figured that I grew up not that far from here, where we're sitting in Sydney, and I had a good education, and I was healthy, and I thought a lot about politics and the country when I was young, and Midnight Oil, some of that was reflected in Midnight Oil with my colleagues there. Going into activism was just a very natural step for me, and then into politics as well. So I don't see it as the three things. They all morph into one, but it's been a busy 40 years, no question.
No question. Well, just thinking about the politics within Midnight Oil, were you guys sitting around just arguing about ways to fix the world, together as band members, or were some of them more political than others within the band?
Look, it's quite a good and a common question, John, but I think the way of seeing Midnight Oil is to see five musicians who respected one another and enjoyed playing together and made this sound on stage. We had a number of writers, I mean, Rob Hurst and Jim Magini, very accomplished songwriters. And there we are, starting to travel through the pubs, then we start heading out of Sydney, and then we're in Wollongong and Newcastle, and then we make our way around the country. And we're just absorbing things. We're just young guys absorbing what's going on around us like blotting paper. And we weren't the kind of people who were so interested in how successful the band was, and we didn't get into music so we could meet girls, which, I mean, we did meet some girls, and some of us settled down and married them. But
it's a happy byproduct.
Yeah, exactly. It just wasn't what we were on about. And the songs that come about are much more natural than us sitting down and having a meeting and deciding, okay, which agendas is Midnight Oil going to deal with today? And in fact, I think if you go and listen to the whole of the catalogue, there's all kinds of songs in Midnight Oil catalogue. We happen to be well known for A Beds Are Burning or A Blue Sky Mine, but in actual fact, we wrote about a whole bunch of different things over time. And we did it because we were citizens of the road, and this is what we were seeing and experiencing.
Yeah, well, but, that said, a lot of bands roam the world and end up writing, "I want to hold your hand." And the world doesn't influence them and give them ideas, and they don't travel out west and have a view about climate change or have a view about the indigenous population. This has happened to you guys. You guys were the ones who sort of came in and you ended up writing these kinds of songs rather than songs based just on romance or just on the sort of the common tropes. This, to my mind, when I was a kid, when I listened to this, this was the first foray into politics for me.
Yeah.
It was your music.
No, that's right. And I think for a lot of people, when they first heard the Oils, if they hadn't been in a situation of being in a family where politics was discussed or they weren't taking much interest in current affairs, then it probably was the first time. Well, lots of other people had that other stuff covered, and it just wasn't our thing. We just weren't as interested in that as we were interested in the world and events and finding a way to do it creatively. I mean, I think I, from the start, was pretty keen on us connecting with the world around us, and we were very independently minded. We had our own label for a while with Seven. We used to run our own gigs, and with Gary Morris, who managed us, we had a very independent streak of wanting to control everything that we did and to think about the consequences, the ramifications of what happened. And as we started to write, and especially I think as Rob and Jim started to grow as songwriters, it just became a character of Midnight Oil that we were expressing as we went around the place. And you know what? It's not that unusual. I mean, you find it in other people's music. It's just that maybe we distilled it a bit more than others have done. Mm. And of course, then we had this amazing set of experiences, including travelling to the Western Desert, connecting with Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people, being influenced by their music, meeting activist groups, touring overseas, doing protest concerts. I mean, the whole thing sort of takes on a life of its own at one point.
Yeah. So at what point do you think in your career you had settled that the public life would extend past music, do you think, and into that realm of politics? So in not necessarily in activism, but in the politics that we know now, that you had that long career with?
Well, in the memoir, it's interesting for me because I realised I actually started pretty early. And there's a section where I'm heading off to the Constitutional Commission, which was originally established in the 80s by the Hawke government, or the Keating government, the Hawke government. And everyone's scratching their head and going, what are you doing this for? Or why are you doing this? You know, I had it in my head that this was something that I wanted to be a part of. So I think I've always been like that and interested in extending my involvement in public life to the issues that I felt were important at the time. And the band always provided the space for me to do that. I mean, I ran as a candidate for the Nuclear Disarmament Party in the mid-80s whilst we were on tour. So I was campaigning by day and we were touring at night and we were playing big shows. And I mean, it was an incredible time. But it kind of felt right.
Well, the memoir, reading your book, I mean, the dedication you guys put into that career, that choice, you know, and there are lots of people probably jumping up and starting bands and doing pubs and the like, but you guys really seem to have a really tough work ethic to really do all that. I mean, that's tiring stuff.
Look, I don't think you can succeed on your own terms, let alone succeed, unless you're really prepared to put in the hard yards. And I'd learned when I was at ANU and I started in music, and you know, I think I'm talking about the fact that you're just stumbling around a bit in the dark and you really don't know how to make it work for yourself. And I knew that one thing that did work was getting in front of people and, you know, busting a gut. And that was our ethic. And then pretty much when you got on stage, to really try and find that place inside you where you may not be alive tomorrow, so give it everything you've got tonight. Because that's how young people feel.
Yeah.
And if you make the music sound like that, then it's going to move people. And so we did, you're right, we threw ourselves at it with a lot of intensity and a lot of energy and a lot of sweat. But by the same token, you built up a relationship with people where they were giving back to you at the same time. So it was a two-way street. It's not a one-way street, I don't think, performing. But I think if you perform with everything that you have without reservation, then you touch people. And then, of course, they'll come back and they'll support you and you can build a career.
Both Andrew and I love to talk to anyone who's written a book about actually the process of doing it, because it's, people go, hey, one day I'll knock out a book, or it's bloody hard work. Like it takes a lot of dedication, as you've already shown you have the right stuff to do it. How did you approach putting this memoir down on paper?
I agree. I mean, one thing that I've come away with having written Big Blue Sky is a huge amount of respect and awe for authors that write more than one book. Like, keep on writing them and write them well.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You know, it is something that's work. And I knew that. I'd written a bit in the past. Obviously, I've written oil lyrics and different things. So I knew that it was going to be a work process. And I knew that if I was going to get it done at all, I'd have to be quite disciplined. So I pretty much set myself a standard working day, a little bit shorter hours than what I was used to, which was kind of nice. I sketched out what I wanted to say on big pieces of computer paper and sort of had a bit of a roadmap. And then I decided I need to know what happened at the beginning and have a beginning that worked for me, and then it'll pick up chronologically because it's a memoir, so you know, it's about my life when I was a kid as well, growing up in Sydney. And I try and write somewhere between 600 and 800 words a day, and what I found happened was I'd get through till about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon and I'd run out of puff. Occasionally I'd pick up a guitar. On Friday I'd come back and kind of go through everything I'd done and re-edit, and then I'd put it into the computer. So I wrote longhand, half the book's written longhand. And then I'd type it into, like, the word processing program. And then just kept on going like that.
Wow. So you just mentioned the guitar. I mean, we can say no to this. But did it spawn any lyrics that coming off this writing process?
Oh, look, there's probably a few things lying around. You know, it's all low-key at the moment. But it was interesting. It was kind of like, you know, that sort of creative side of my brain got liberated again, if you like, which was really great, actually. And I was quite surprised with that.
I want to talk about that because you made a choice of where you started your book. And you started your book in sort of the end. Yeah. Having had such a path which sort of took you to through music, which was quite political, through activism to politics, to leave that office in the opening scene is Peter pretty much leaving the office for the last time in Parliament. as someone who had that drive, and how did you cope in that period that came afterwards? Because it was people get to the point, I did what I set out to do. I climbed Everest, I went to the moon. And then they leave afterwards going, what am I going to do now? Like, was some of that there in that period as you're walking out going, I actually did what I came here to do, or I got some of the things that I really wanted to get done. What do I do now?
I don't think about life like that.
Okay.
So I tend to think about life about the day and the week and the month, but not so much looking behind and not so much looking ahead. And I think I don't want to be the person that's sitting around here telling people, you know, how to get their lives in order, because mine isn't always in order either. But one thing I guess I can say I have learned in terms of being a productive person is I don't fret too much about the small stuff, and I don't think too much about what could have been or what might have been. And I find that if I do that, I get through more, and I'm not replaying it all in my head, you know, the what ifs or where next. I was disappointed to leave in that way, only in as much as it was an incredible opportunity for me to work at a high level of public life in the Parliament. And I had a lot of time for the place. And even if you don't make really close friends there, there were lots of people who I would consider good colleagues. I liked the public service, even though they let me down a bit on the way through. I think they served the country really well. The sort of stuff that you never read about or ever hear about. How does this country work? You know, how do all these things happen? And if you arrive from another country and, you know, you walk into the RTA and, you know, sort of someone hands you the slip and the little number comes out and people are polite and it happens in time and you don't bribe anybody and you've got your driver's license, it's like magic. And there are many other examples. So I think it's a long-winded way of saying I didn't think that much about it. I would have probably preferred to come out in slightly different circumstances, but I'd made my call and I was incredibly lucky to have done 10 years there.
So if you're at home watching the nightly news and you see a Labour reshuffle and a new leader rises up and you go, he's got that, or he or she has got the stuff. Would you be tempted if they could, like, would they have any chance of luring you back into politics?
Well, Mr. Shorten is the leader and he'll contest the election and I hope he beats Turnbull, you know.
Yeah. Mm.
No, I won't go back into politics. I think there's plenty of people coming through and fresh faces and people with lots of energy. And I gave it my best for a decade. And I wasn't factionally aligned in the party. And even though that ultimately wasn't a big problem for me and I managed it, it did take a bit of time to manage that stuff. It's all invisible. It's politics. It's not that interesting, actually, but you've just got to manage it. And I think that it's quite challenging to have that role when you're not factionally aligned. And there's plenty of other things that I'd love to do. So, you know, we'll see.
It's fascinating. I just want to, because I think it's interesting, obviously, you know, you're a very intelligent man. You pulled out as a law student to Midnight Oil, to activism, everything like that. What were the initial challenges when you went into politics from there? I guess maybe not necessarily, but when you talk about the factions as well, because you were Peter Garrett, and it was a big coup when he came in. That was one of I remember when you first came into cabinet. Kevin Rudd was, this is my guy. Look at him. What were some of the challenges that you found coming in when you already had a profile into people that had sort of been set in since university?
Look, I think the biggest challenge for people is that expectations are very high and everybody already has an idea in their head about what either they want you to do or what you're like as a person. And you've got a lot of media scrutiny and some of it is mischievous. It's kind of interested to sort of knock you down a few pegs.
Mischievous is a wonderful way to put it, Peter, I think. Yeah,
I'm being as polite as I can.
It is. That's an exceptional way to put it.
Dirty dogs. But, you know, I came in and I went to the backbench and I arguably could have asked for something a bit further up the food chain, but I thought the right thing to do. I wanted to earn the respect of my colleagues and of the Parliament, so I decided to stay on the backbench and just progress, as it were, like any other backbencher would, although obviously I wasn't quite like any other backbencher. And with the factions and with people in the party, I just had to build constructive relationships with people which were trustworthy and which over time could withstand factional realignments or, you know, political coups or whatever.
It's fascinating. I just want to. Do you want to talk
a little bit more?
I just want to talk. Just go back to Midnight Oil, and at the peak of Midnight Oil, we talk about touring everything, and these are the parts that I've read because the book has been. It is. I need to stress the listeners. It is one of the most anticipated books of the year. So John has read it, and I've been able to skim through it. But I've lived in Neutral Bay for a period of time. John has as well. John grew up there. There was a fairly seminal Australian album that was recorded there, and it was a pretty simple process.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, this is the incredible thing about it. You can strain and struggle to bring a bit of work to bear, and it may not sort of fly with wings, and then you can go to a recording studio in Neutral Bay, which is where the Albert studio was, next to the shopping centre. I mean, it's attached to the Neutral Bay shopping centre. It just looks like an office block, little office building. And, of course, that's where we did... Diesel and Dust with the English producer Warren Livesey in about 5 or 6 weeks.
God.
Yeah, I know. I look back on it. I'm not quite sure how we managed it. But.
And just for one more thing, we talk about the music as well. What I was talking to John about earlier before you came in was when I listen back to Midnight Oil, I see an incredibly strong themes of Australian issues throughout. Yet you found so much success overseas. I mean, a lot of that, as you said, it's to do with the music, it's to do with people making music. But do you think that the themes that Australia's exploring, everything that we're struggling with now, because we're such a young country, people have either seen overseas or they're going through those same experiences, do you think that's why it resonated, a lot of that music?
Look, it's hard to know what turns people on when they listen to music from other places. I mean, part of it is whether the music works for them. I think the other thing at the time was that music television, MTV, and music videos were just starting out, and everybody was pretty much doing the same thing, dancing, jumping around, you know, bright lights, maybe, you know, people doing moves or whatever. And suddenly we arrived with this very different connection to a very different culture with very different colours and shapes and quite a different sensibility. And I mean, the Aboriginal people that we played to when we went into the desert before we recorded Diesel and Dust had a big impact on us. And that relationships have continued in some places to this day and have been important to us. But they kind of really disconnected us from the music machine and from what was going on in Western music. And it was all like, oh, hang on a minute, actually, we've been here for a very long time. This actually is our country. It's got different rhythms. We're happy to share our stories with you and let's see, you know, what a conversation sounds like. And then you get an album that comes out of that, which reflects some of that. And that translated overseas in ways which people probably found a bit difficult to describe. French people, for example, and German people really responded very strongly to Midnight Oil. I think it was partly political awareness, partly exotic looking thing, partly the strength of the songs, and the time, you know, it was just the times.
I want to just head back onto the book just a little bit, because the way in which you tell us, it's a very... the way in which you actually write your story, you digress here and there, and you wonder about what happens is you end up with this weave of time. It's not a direct lineal line right through from beginning to end. You do jump ahead in certain parts, and it becomes a very rich read. How did you manage, because you've got so many little stories to put in, how did you manage to keep that side of it, where you've got an anecdote here, which then leads on to this anecdote here, which then brings in this, which went over, and we've... When you get into the period where you start to be involved in the Constitutional Commission and then into activism, you've got two lives or three lives running at the one time. So you do get this wonderful weave of the part story saying you were hanging out with Jimmy Barnes one moment, and then you're talking to Thomas Keneally about the Constitution the next. It doesn't stop. It runs right through that way. There's so much going on. That, for me, would be a really tough task for anyone writing that sort of putting it together.
Look, I did find it challenging. There were the two daunting things about writing this memoir. The first was a memoir itself, because I'm a reasonably private sort of person. I've had a very public life, but I've been pretty private, and people will hear that expression a bit, I guess. But I knew that if I was going to explain a little bit more what I'd done and share it with people, that I needed to find, you know, I'm very blokey, I don't go to the doctor, you know. So sort of share a bit more of the thinking and the emotion behind what was happening. And of course, part of that is my family and the fact that they, you know, my beautiful wife and the kids have stuck with me through thick and thin, you know, particularly in difficult periods when the absences were quite challenging. And the second daunting thing was to find a way of making it work as a read, because I didn't want to write an insider's account, and I didn't want to write a book which just simply said, well, I did this and then I did that and then we did this and then we did that and, you know, here's a story and there's something happened and, you know, we, the gear rolled over and so on and so forth. So I tried to see which bits as I was writing just almost organically arrived and how I expressed them, and I sort of really trusted that process up to a point, and ended up with a lot of stuff and a lot of material, some of it kind of working and some of it which wasn't working. And then of course, you know, I had a terrific publisher and Jane Pulfreman from Allen & Unwin, and some really good editing come, and they, you know, this stuff knocks books into shape big time, particularly for people who aren't professional writers like me. And the other amazing thing though was that there was synchronicity at play. And I don't know if you discovered this, John, when you read Big Blue Sky, but I was surprised at the synchronicity. And we've all got it in our lives, you know, and suddenly it was showing up in the page as I was writing again and again. So in some ways my life made it easy for me to write the book if I just let the telling take place page after page.
Well, I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Now, I think that it's going to be one of the... You're going to have to get used to people reading this on beaches and on public transport.
Oh, I hope
you'll
so.
You'll see your
airports will be chasing you at every airport.
Yeah, airports will be walking past me. They'd be, because I think people are not only just interested in what's going on in your life, and it could have been just, as you said, one of those and then. But this is an enjoyable read, well-written read, that I think people are going to really find quite enlightening in certain parts there, and also a great reminiscence. Yeah, so the way in which you conjure up some of those, the 80s, the 70s and the 80s, it will remind a lot of people of their past and their time.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. And thank you so much, Peter. It's been an absolute privilege to talk to you.
Thanks, gentlemen.
And remember, at home, you can get Big Blue Sky from booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.